This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Two views on the debt ceiling, one from deep inside the Beltway.
And one from far outside of the Beltway.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org on this Friday, July 22nd.
Coming up, we'll hear from a Democratic member of the Senate's Gang of Six on the debt ceiling.
We're going to hear from the Republican mayor of Mesa, Arizona about the debt ceiling.
Also, what trends are shaping up at America's biggest companies this earnings season?
And the heat wave can drive people to do some crazy things. Wait till you hear what happened in Texas last weekend.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
Let's start now with two newsmaker interviews about the debt ceiling debate in Washington. President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner have turned up the heat to get some sort of debt limit deal, but are still reportedly very far apart on the amount of budget cuts and tax increases.
But there is one proposal crafted by a bipartisan group of senators dubbed the Gang of Six that's gaining traction as a long-term solution. It would cut $3.7 trillion from the federal budget, including from Medicare and Medicaid, and also raise some taxes. Democratic Senator Kent Conrad represents North Dakota. He is that member of the Gang of Six that we're welcoming to our program now. Senator, thanks.
Glad to be with you.
The president says now he's going to support a very short-term solution to raise the debt limit, to give Congress a few more days to reach a deal. Is that enough time, or do you think you need more time?
You know, it's hard to say, isn't it? It depends very much on what one's goal is. You know, the Group of Six has worked on a plan for many months not to extend the debt. Our plan was designed to deal with the debt itself, a comprehensive plan, a balanced plan to reduce the debt from what it would otherwise be by about $4 trillion. So our goal was never to be part of extending the debt limit. But we've been brought into that discussion because, frankly, there's very little appetite in Congress to extend the debt unless the debt itself is dealt with. And that's why our group becomes relevant. To get all of what we have worked on enacted could not be done in just a few days. The beginning process, and we have a two-step process, a down payment followed by very fundamental reform of our tax system, because we've got a tax system that's badly out of date, and also reform to our entitlement programs. Those are not things that can be done quickly. And in addition to that, of course, spending cuts, discretionary spending and defense spending, these are not decisions that can be made just in days. They're going to take weeks and months to reach a final conclusion on.
But something's got to be done, sir, by August 2nd, right? I mean, or
yes,
the nation defaults.
The debt, and that's why I've tried to divide up these two issues. The extension of the debt, that's one issue. That's on a separate track. Obviously, something's got to be done by August 2nd, or the United States would default. If we failed to meet our obligations, the consequences would be catastrophic. Because as soon as you don't pay your bills in the international community and you've borrowed trillions of dollars, which we have, guess what happens? Interest rates for your future borrowing jump, and they jump dramatically. And just to give you a rule of thumb, for every 1% our interest rates go up, that adds $1.3 trillion to our debt.
So what happens? What do we do?
So my own belief is we've got to have a short-term extension of the debt tied to a commitment to a longer-term plan that gets our debt under control. It will take months to put in place all the policy changes necessary to get America back on track, but we can have a commitment to that process now and an assurance that that process leads to a result.
If we don't do this right now, do you think the momentum goes away to get this done?
I frankly don't, because the rating agencies are telling us if we aren't showing serious steps at making progress at dealing with the debt itself, they will downgrade U.S. debt. That would mean higher interest rates. That would mean, as I've indicated, more debt, an even deeper hole to dig out of. So I think, you know, if people think carefully about this, if they think rationally about this, they'll understand the time for kicking this issue down the road is about to come to an end.
Who do you think is going to blink in this this game of brinksmanship?
I think all sides are going to have to blink, because what's necessary here is for all sides to give some ground. I mean, all of us have things that we care a lot about. I certainly do. And the hard reality is we're going to have to reform our entitlement programs. We're going to have to reform the tax system. We're going to have to cut some spending programs. There is absolutely no way to address a circumstance in which we're borrowing 41 cents of every dollar we spend without there being some hurt feelings.
Your plan would cut, the plan that you have looked at and have offered up, would cut heavily from health care programs such as Medicaid. You mentioned entitlements, Medicare. Does this plan cut the deficit on the backs of the neediest, do you think, sir?
I don't. This is widely distributed pain, which it has to be when we're got the lowest revenue in the last 60 years as a share of our economy, and the highest spending in 60 years as a share of the economy. You referenced the health care savings. Frankly, I think they're relatively modest. $500 billion is a big number, but you got to remember what's scheduled to be spent over that period, which is well over $10 trillion. So $500 billion out of $10 trillion is, you know, relatively modest. It's 5% of what we're scheduled to spend.
I know taxes have been a huge sticking point, obviously, for Republicans. And Congressman Paul Ryan has said that your plan would raise taxes more than $2 trillion over the next 10 years or so. But you say your plan would actually lower taxes. How did those two things jibe?
That's a very good question, and it all depends on what you are comparing to. What I have referenced is the Congressional Budget Office, which is the official scorekeeper here, says compared to current law, the Group of Six reduces taxes $1.5 trillion over 10 years. Congressman Ryan is comparing our plan to what's called a plausible baseline, what's most likely to occur in policy going forward, and of course that's a guess. And he's saying we'd get $2 trillion more in revenue than that so-called plausible baseline. The difference between what CBO is projecting and this alternative measurement is the Congressional Budget Office looks at current law. And current law, all the Bush tax cuts expire at the end of next year. Compared to that plan, we cut taxes $1.5 trillion. Compared to allowing most of the tax cuts to continue, our plan raises $2 trillion.
Your plan has the support of many moderates, but I wonder if we're going to see this broad plan, and yet those on the extreme left or on the extreme right are going to oppose it and try and bring it down at the last minute, kind of like what happened with the TARP, the bank bailout legislation, a few years back.
It could, and the country would be the loser. You know, there is a reality out here, and the reality is that our debt level now is approaching the same size as our entire economy. That has not been the case since after World War II. Two of the most distinguished economists in the country just completed a 200-year review of 44 countries and found that once your debt gets above 90% of the size of your economy, your future economic prospects are diminished. So this isn't just numbers on a page. This has everything to do with future opportunity, job creation, the strength of our country, and whether or not America has got better days ahead or whether we can expect a diminished future for our people. I'm very hopeful that we're better than the notion of just doing nothing in the face of what is clearly a peril. I believe that this country and this Congress is better than those who say just stick with the current course, which is completely unsustainable by almost any measure.
We've been on a trajectory of this debt-to-economy sort of ratio. Why haven't we seen this coming?
Well, we have. Senator Judd Gregg, who is the ranking member on the Budget Committee, and I, 5 years ago, started raising this alarm, proposing first a commission that was rejected by our colleagues, even though a majority voted for it. You know, in the Senate, you got to get 60 votes out of 100 to advance legislation. We got 53. The president then took our ideas and put it in the form of a presidential commission. We concluded our work last year and proposed a plan to save $4 trillion, very close to the conclusions of the Group of Six that's worked 6 months this year, hundreds and hundreds of hours to fashion a plan in anticipation of the moment that we're in. So there have been those of us who have worked for a long time in preparation for this moment. And, you know, it's very hard to convince people to make changes, even if they're relatively modest, because I think it's human nature to cling to the status quo.
Senator Kent Conrad, Democrat from North Dakota. Senator, thank you.
You bet.
Let's get some analysis now on this whole debt ceiling debate. And Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large at CBS Money Watch. She's with us from New York, as she is every Friday. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
I want to talk a little bit about what the senator said. He talks about these big cuts, right, and also shared sacrifice. How are everyday folks feeling about all this?
You know, in a recent CBS News poll that we conducted last week, two-thirds of respondents think any agreement on the budget and the debt ceiling should include a combination of spending cuts and tax increases. But, you know, these are two distinct issues. As Conrad said, there's the long-term debt. That's what the Gang of Six is addressing. And then there's the immediate debt ceiling problem. The August 2nd deadline on the debt ceiling has just catalyzed this larger issue, but they are really separate issues.
It's brought it to the forefront, exactly. Now, the word in Washington, Jill, is about patching something together by first passing something short term, as you say, to meet this default deadline coming up. How do you think that's going to play with the financial markets and the ratings agencies that are threatening to downgrade?
Well, you know, I do think this is the first time we've seen a viable game plan that addresses the nation's debt. And ratings agencies and investors don't expect that the debt ceiling debate's going to produce the tidy solution, but they do want to see that there's a plan for action. And I think when the Gang of Six reconvened, one international investor said to me, it finally looks like there are adults at the table.
Adults at the table. All right. Jill Schlesinger from CBS Money Watch. Jill, have a great weekend.
You too.
Now to a view from far away from Washington. Here in Los Angeles today, 50 mayors from around the country are meeting to urge Congress to come up with something fast when it comes to raising the debt ceiling. One of those mayors is Republican Scott Smith. He's the mayor of Mesa, Arizona, and he joins me now in our L.A. studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why are you so worried in Mesa about the consequences of a default in Washington?
Cities are where economic activity happens. Over 85% of the economic output of this country happens in cities. This is where the jobs are. Over the next 5 years, over 95% of the new jobs in America will happen in cities. So the economy is, of course, our greatest concern because this is where the action is.
And you're worried that a default would hurt the economy in Mesa?
Well, we're worried that the risk of what might happen. I know there's a lot of debate over whether default is as bad as people think it is. We just believe that it's the risk is too great to toy with. We don't know exactly what it'll be. We don't want to find out.
What about the idea of cuts that would come along with any package to raise the debt ceiling? Would you be okay with that?
We understand in cities more than I think anyone else because we're the one level of government where we have to balance our budgets. Republicans and Democrats alike have taken great steps to cut costs, cut services to bring our financial house in order. We understand that debate. And I think overall, especially mayors appreciate the debate that's going on in Washington about how to cut expenditures. On the other hand, we like smart cuts. We've learned in the cities that you can make cuts that really create more damage than they actually create savings. And that's what we're concerned about as mayors.
What specifically would you feel in Mesa if there were big cuts at the federal level?
Well, you know, the federal government doesn't give that much direct aid to cities anymore. But the aid that they do give us and the financial contribution they give it are to handle things that are societal issues. For example, in Mesa, we take some of our federal money to run a men's shelter. That men's shelter is made up primarily of homeless men, many of them vets. And just because cuts are made in Washington or in our state capitals doesn't mean that the needs go away. Those men are still homeless. They're still vets. They have mental health issues. And if we don't have the money, we still have to pay the price. And that price usually is much greater if we have to depend upon public safety and other officials to take care of it than if we get this aid.
Well, you're a Republican mayor. What do you make of the GOP position in the House, which is basically either don't raise the debt ceiling, or if you're going to raise the debt ceiling, have an equal amount of cuts to the federal budget and don't raise taxes?
As a Republican, I understand the debate and the intensity of the debate in Washington over the budget. And I appreciate that they're having that kind of discussion. I get the political posturing, all that role. But we want to make sure that we understand that we didn't get into this overnight. Congress and the executive branch have got us into this over many, many years. And if we're going to slam on the brakes, understand there are consequences. There are real consequences that maybe create more disproportionate damage than I think the point that we're making. And in cities, we've had to make quick cuts, hard cuts, deep cuts. But we've tried to make smart cuts. We've tried to make cuts that don't create more damage than they're intended to.
Would you be okay with a federal tax increase?
I think that looking at loopholes, looking at revenue issues definitely have to be on the table. I believe that we have to have some kind of balance. And I think that will enhance revenue. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Once again, you can't take things off the table that could help solve the problem. Mayors are pragmatic. We want to solve problems. And I think on this one, the solution to the problem will involve all different tools.
Finally, while you're here, let me just ask you, how's the economic recovery going in Mesa?
Not as quickly as we'd hope. There's a lot of bright spots in the economy. It seems like I've gone to a lot of ribbon cuttings lately. But overall, we're still dragged down by the lack of construction activity, the lack of real activity. There's just a lot of uncertainty, and people are holding on to their money, both consumers and businesses. We need investment. We need consumer spending. We need certainty in Washington. We need these problems solved so we can get back to creating jobs and spending money.
Republican Scott Smith is the mayor of Mesa, Arizona. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
Now to the Marketplace Global perspective. Greece today said the second European bailout will give it the breathing space it needs. And the country's leaders promise they're not going to back down from the tough public spending cuts they've had to agree to in order to get that rescue cash.
In a moment, we'll hear what Germans think about picking up the tab for Greece again. But on the streets of Greece, people are angry by all the restrictions and cuts forced by the bailout. In fact, today, much of the country is shut down by a taxi strike as cab drivers protest increased competition to their business.
From Athens, reporter Joanna Kakissis went to the streets and talked to some average Greeks about why they're so unhappy.
Christos Kouloutzos is a tire salesman in Athens. He says the first batch of international bailout loans issued last year did nothing to help the country. In fact, he says the austerity measures that the government had to impose to get those loans only made Greeks poor. He says a second bailout will mean more budget cuts and tax hikes and desperation for the average Greek who can't pay his bills. Where is he going to get the money to survive, Kouloutzos says. He'd have to rob a bank, he says. The second bailout is worth about $155 billion. The Greek finance minister called Europe's decision to give those loans a great relief. In Athens, I'm Joanna Kakissis for Marketplace.
I'm the BBC's Steve Evans in Berlin. Germans, just like anybody else, do not like the idea of their tax money going to bail out other people and other economies. And as Europe's been debating the Greek debt crisis, Germany's continually expressed unease and unhappiness about sending bailout money 1,000 miles south. But new public opinion polls show Germans are split right down the middle on whether a bailout is a good idea. Ingrid Nessler is the economic spokeswoman for Germany's Green Party. She says she supports the deal, partly because of the need for European solidarity and partly because of the profits Germany makes by selling things to other countries.
The really well-running German economy is based mainly on exports that go to a large part into Europe. So we have really gained from the euro and from the European integration. And it would be a problem for us as well if the euro blows up.
But Nestle says it could have gone even further with the private sector taking a bigger hit. So as the second bailout of Greece is finalised, it seems like it's been broadly accepted by most in Germany. But a third bailout, if it were necessary in the coming months, might be a different matter. In Berlin, I'm the BBC's Steve Evans for Marketplace.
Now to China, which is shipping something to the United States this week that is a whole lot bigger than an iPhone or a piece of clothing, Jeremy. It is sending over part of the Bay Bridge, which connects San Francisco and Oakland and carries 250,000 vehicles a day. Interesting story about that. Of course, the Bay Bridge was damaged in the Loma Prieta earthquake of 1989. And now they're trying to fix the bridge, and they've been doing it for many years. And part of that bridge is coming from China. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports from Shanghai.
Here, on an island where the Yangtze River meets the Pacific, is where Li Jianghua wants to prove a point. For years, he says, the world has looked down on anything made in China. Times are changing.
This project should help finish off the idea that made in China stands for poor quality.
China is upgrading from the world's factory to the world's engineer. Lee's crew is putting the finishing touches on the last of four sections of bridge that are being shipped to San Francisco this week. California officials estimate they've saved nearly $500 million by hiring Li's company, Shanghai Jinhua, to build the eastern span of the new Bay Bridge. In the 5 years it's taken the company to build it, Li says this island has become the world's largest steel construction site.
After we landed the Bay Bridge project, more international projects came our way. We're now working on bridges for Denmark, Italy, Scotland, Macau, and Norway.
Sections of bridges are scattered all over the island. UC Berkeley engineering professor William Ibbs says Jinhua reminds him of big American engineering firms like Fluor and Bechtel, firms that have spent decades building a global profile.
And they've been exporting American skill and expertise to those countries. Well, here we have, you know, a reversal of the situation where Chinese skill and expertise is being exported into America.
Unlike international construction firms outside China, Jinhua's labor costs are low. Workers here are paid $12 an hour. And there's another difference, says Li. Jinhua finished the project 5 months ahead of schedule. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
From the travels of Bay Area residents to the travels of our politicians abroad, Jeremy, President Obama owes the city of London $193.
That's it?
Yeah, that's, yeah. Well, last time Mr. Obama visited the British capital, back in May, his limo, nicknamed the Beast, I had no idea the limo was nicknamed the Beast, never paid the $16 congestion fee to drive into the city center. There's a fee, I guess, because there are so many people and so many cars in London. Well, at the time, the mayor of London reportedly told the president about the congestion fee. When they were meeting, he brought it up, but he was never given payment. And the president is not alone in disregarding the fee. London Sun newspaper reports American diplomats there at the U.S. Embassy and at other places have racked up more than $8 million worth of fines since the congestion fees were introduced in 2003.
You think that the two sides of the Atlantic could just forgive each other's debt on these fees? Because I know that when I lived in New York, that the big story was that the diplomats never paid their
immunity. They claim immunity.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. And so we're doing the same thing over there. We've got debt problems in Washington, and apparently we got them in London.
This is one way to solve them.
Yeah.
Now let's get to corporate earnings. Two of America's biggest companies reported strong results this morning, McDonald's and General Electric. Chris Lowe is chief economist with FTN Financial. He is with us from Chicago this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with McDonald's. Chris, what's the story there? Why are they doing so well?
Well, this is a double story. Part of it is that McDonald's, like most of the S&P 500, is doing a lot more business overseas. McDonald's had a terrific quarter outside the U.S. But McDonald's has also benefited by a trend among consumers. People are pinching pennies, and they're moving down. So they picked up business from some of their more expensive competitors.
The old fast food economic indicator. But what about GE? They're not making cheap burgers. So how are they doing so well?
No, that's right. Well, GE is benefiting also from two trends. One of them is that the airlines are starting to spend more money. They've been pinching pennies for so many years. Their fleets are starting to wear out. We had record orders, in fact, just this week from American Airlines, and that was part of it. The rest is green energy.
Green energy, what do you mean?
Well, you know, the federal government has put billions of dollars into green energy projects, and it turns out GE makes a ton of the stuff that's used to make green energy, like wind turbines.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
To the world of magazines now, which have been a little thinner when it comes to advertising ever since the recession hit. But it looks like things have turned around. As Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports from New York, the doorstopper fall fashion magazine is back.
Ad sales are up for the all-important September issue of many fashion magazines. Vogue will have 584 ad pages this fall, 50 more pages than last year. Cosmo and Marie Claire will be a lot thicker as well.
Well, we're seeing a turnaround in parts of the industry.
Ken Doctor is a media industry analyst for Outsell. He says it's not because of discounting. As consumer spending rebounds, clothing and cosmetic companies are flocking back to magazines because they have a unique appeal that online media can't match.
It is the old-fashioned leafing through. The pleasure of the magazine, the glossy color of the magazine, it is that kind of medium that delivers attractive advertising about attractive products.
Still, Doctor points out things are bleak in much of the industry. At newspapers and news weeklies like Time and Newsweek, ad revenue continues to drop. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
And finally, Steve, there is a heat wave going on. Did you know that? It doesn't really feel like it.
What's
here in
the
LA.
High here in LA today?
78.
Yeah. Wow.
but anyway, no,
we
don't mean
to
laugh
about it. Tell my folks back
in
Alabama, they're sweltering at 100 degrees.
Getting,
your friends in New York.
I'm getting calls from people, and they are just so angry about how hot it is and how bad the weather is right now.
And then they ask, "How's the weather in California?"
No, they never ask that question. Actually, but regardless, in most of the country, it is making a lot of people just want to jump into a nice, cool swimming pool. Or
nice.
Maybe steal one.
What?
That happened to a homeowner in Richland Hills, Texas. According to the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the 10-foot-tall orange and blue pool and its water slide.
They took the water slide, too.
They were taken last weekend by unidentified pool thieves.
Mm.
Too bad for the homeowner because, Steve, it may be 78 degrees in L.A. today, but it's going to be 102 in Richland Hills.
That's swell.
No pool either.
That's awful.
That's too bad.
Oh.
Well, I don't know what we're going to do here in Los Angeles, but...
go swimming. No, maybe
this,
not.
You know what? Let me 102 degrees.
That's crazy hot.
It is crazy hot. Yeah. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. Have a great weekend. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.